Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Sociology. I'm Felipe Santos, and today I'm going to be talking to Professor Austin Choi Fitzpatrick from the University of San Diego and the University of Nottingham about his new book, What Does Slaveholder Think? How Contemporary Perpetrators Rationalize What They Do, from Columbia University Press. Austin, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I was hoping that to start the interview, you could just like tell us a bit about your path, like where you've been working before, where you're working now, and so on.
It all started a long, long time ago on a trout farm in Pennsylvania where I was born. I don't know how far back you want me to go. I'm at the University of San Diego now. I'm a concurrent faculty member at the University of Nottingham, where I'm part of something called the Rights Lab, which is a consortium of scholars working on contemporary slavery issues and abolition. And here at the University of San Diego, I'm at the Kroc School of Peace Studies, where we work on peace and conflict issues. Before this, I was at Central European University's School of Public Policy, where we know each other from. It's good to see you. And was very, very happy to be there for a number of years as they were doing something they've been doing for a long time, which is to be promoting open society and open inquiry and academic excellence in places where those things are not always welcome, but are desperately needed. And so I think that's the shortest version of my academic career.
And then I found very interesting from the book that instead of doing what most social movement scholars, and I guess that also most slavery scholars do, and talking to, you know, those who challenge the system or those who suffer it, you went and talked to basically slaveholders themselves. So how do you come to the idea of writing this book?
Well, I mean, that's why we're in this game, right? We want to change the world, and we want to change the world for the better and on behalf of people who have been left out of economic systems, political systems, social systems. And so I think like many other social movement scholars, I approached this issue like I approached lots of issues, thinking who's left out, where are resources, why are they not being properly assessed and shared? And this is before coming to the, you know, my scholarly work on social movements, but as an activist working within the activist space for nonprofits, this is what I care about. It's why I joined the movement, right? And then when I entered sort of the social movement scholarship space, I realized that was what social movement scholars thought and cared about. And it's this wonderful sort of homecoming to go from kind of activist land into academic land and find many people with similar sets of motivations. And so I found that to be very comforting in some ways. Simultaneously, though, it means that we don't always ask questions about the other half of relationships of exploitation. We don't always ask questions about perpetrators. For example, in the civil rights era, civil rights scholarship in the United States has focused predominantly on what it took for movements to mobilize and succeed, and a lot less time on who were the folks who were against equality and who was it that was in favor of segregation. I should start collecting biographies of Bull Connor, because it would be easy to do. There's hardly any of them because he's not celebrated. He's forgotten. And along with the forgetting of the bad guys, we forget the way their logics work. We've under sort of theorize how it is that they are part of the social change that people like me really, really value. So as a long answer to your question, but from a theoretical and sort of scholarly perspective, I think it really matters that people who want to change the world deeply understand people who don't, and for whom the changing of the guard or new ideas and new values and norms threatens the foundations of their existence. This is something that has become all the more important in the last couple of years in my home country, the United States, right? It matters. People who don't want to be part of change matter because they'll come back with more things to say. And if they have the vote, which they should, it has consequences for everyone. So I'll end my monologue by saying we should understand both sides of human rights violations, both sides of struggles for equality.
And then one thing also that I would like to ask you to help us understand better is what you meant by slavery, because oftentimes when we think about slavery, we think it in this way of African Americans in cotton farms that were bought by the slaveholder and they had to stay there their whole lives. But in the book, you present a different take on slavery. So I was hoping that you could explain a bit what is this.
Yeah, so slavery is one of the oldest sort of human relationships. I'm a sociologist. I care about relationships in public. And slavery is a very old form of social relations, and it has taken different forms over the thousands of years of recorded history. And sometimes it's been used to mobilize additional people in war, or it's supported large infrastructural projects, been predominantly exercised by the state, or in other cases, predominantly exercised by religious groups. The slavery that the American public is most familiar with is the most recent and the most proximate. It's stuff that happened here fairly recently. But it's one form out of many forms of slavery. And so I think the communities that I'm part of tend to talk about slavery with down to its constituent parts, which would be the control of one person by another through force, fraud, threats, or coercion for the purpose of capturing that person's total economic capacity. So it's using violence to steal somebody else's productivity and doing that in such a way that prohibits them from doing something else. So the means and manner and mode that takes vary over time. So I was looking in this case at bonded labor in India, something that is a form of contemporary slavery. It's not that contemporary, it's actually quite old, but that has the same set of, controlling people against their will. That same definition applies to bonded labor and to the American South before the Civil War. In both cases, institutions are used to ensure people are held in place. The institution that was used in the United States was the law. Now, slavery is illegal everywhere. And so the dominant institutions that are used to coerce people into these forms of exploitation tend to be economic, psychological, and are less often reinforced by the state and by law. So those modalities change, but the underlying human rights violation, that moment between people, has remained constant. And unfortunately, there's, by our best estimates, more people held in slavery now than at any other point in history. And a lot of that has to do with population explosion. Again, lots and lots of people. And so we're seeing this illegal everywhere, but still practiced in areas where people are able to gain leverage over others.
And then you discuss in the book also how most social movement scholarship, when they have studied targets, they have basically focused on the state, because obviously it has been for a very long time almost the only target that social movements addressed, and it's also probably still the most important one for social movements. But then you say that this kind of definition is more complicated, and there are more actors and contexts that can be also targeted by social movements. So which are those?
So we can look at the movements that are prevalent right now in a couple of national contexts. So the United States has Black Lives Matter, where the challenge is for both police forces and systems of state representation in policing. We have the Me Too movement, which is around, what is that around? Is that trying to take down in particular rights violators, or is it actually tackling and calling into question systems of privilege and oppression, right? So Me Too is a great example. It came from a hashtag and it's targeting patriarchy, right? So again, the call is not that the government should pass anti-discrimination policies, right? The government should step in and pass laws. It's that societies should learn to behave in new ways in relationship to one another. And that's something that the social movement scholarship focused on the importance of the state has done a good job alerting us to the importance of new policies, but has left us less well-resourced, let's say, to talk in enduring ways about social movement targets like corporations. We know very little about if we have a boycott of some sort. How is it that the corporation decides what to do next? How is it that they decide whether or not they're going to raise prices or drop a particular line or respond to the movement? And it's because why? Because we used to be protesters and then we become academics and we don't actually have a lot of friends in some cases who are in the corporations being targeted. And so I think for a bunch of reasons, we are not then aware of what's happening when movements target, let's say, a corporation. And we tend to focus on the state. So.
And then by trying to put targets in the equation of how we analyze social movements and contention more generally, you present an updated version of the classic political process theory. And I think that is very interesting because in the way that you present it, first you make it more interactive because we have two actors that are strategizing, they present dilemmas and so on. And also you kind of like make a good job in bridging these kind of macro and meso level theories of social movements by first presenting a strategic interactions and something that is repeated over time. So it's not a one-off interaction. And also that you show that not only social movements face dilemmas, but also incumbents face dilemmas and they have to evaluate the resources they have. Sometimes they're not good at doing that job. So can you please explain a bit how this updated political process theory looks like after putting emphasis on targets?
You just said it. Your question is the answer to the question. And that's in the second chapter of the book that I say in the first chapter, don't read, because it's very boring. It's very boring social movements sort of insider theory talk. But you've crystallized it exactly and captured it exactly. The punchline, again, from social movement theory, sort of the industry standard of social movement theory from the 80s onward, comes from this political process model that asks, how is it that over time, different actors actually engage around change? And the model itself, when it says different actors, it means the protesters and the incumbents, whoever the powerful was. And so social movement theory, and now we're just going to be very geeky for a minute. Social movement theory has done a good job theorizing that relationship, but a bad job getting into in our field work, getting out there and talking to the other half of that relationship or the other side of that equation. So that, you know, it's a kind of a funny place to be as a scholar where the theory is good. We just haven't gone out to actually talk to the people we say we should have been talking to all along. Because you're right, these are relationships and first moves by a social movement, for example, create responses by the incumbent or by the target, whoever it is they're protesting against. They do something in response, or the police decide we're going to go home, or they decide we're going to break out the batons and the tear gas. They decide to do something next because we're just human. And then the movement huddles and says, well, what are we going to do? How will we respond? And in this way, these social processes play themselves out on the streets or in the back room or on Twitter, and each of those two sides have to figure out how to respond to one another. And they're not just it's not just those two sides. There's the media watching sometimes. There's important other allies that, let's say, the police may have. They're trying to signal allies, or you're trying to convince me to join the movement, and so you're being sure that your tactics and strategies are resonate with my values in a way that I will join and you won't alienate, possible bystanders who might be allies. So all sorts of really interesting and important things are happening there. And we do ourselves a disservice when we just go and talk to protesters, for example. We need to go out and talk to a wider array of actors because that's what real life looks like. I mean, that's actually how all of this works.
So for the listeners that were a bit like lost and were not paying like enough attention to the nerdy social movements talks, we are now getting into the exciting empirical part. That's of
right. Oh, I thought the nerdy stuff was exciting. I was very excited about that. Let's cover the mic. We can keep talking about it. Okay, we have work to do. Let's go.
Okay, so then one of the interesting things that you present here is that what you said before, that slavery is illegal everywhere. But in many places, such as these ones that you're presenting, it's not necessarily culturally condemned. So how do these human rights violators rationalize their position as slaveholders? How do they understand themselves?
Yeah, I love this question. Okay, so I'm not a criminologist. And my area of expertise is not why do lawbreakers break the law, or why do people find themselves in positions where it's important or necessary for them to engage in lawbreaking activity. I'm most interested in what happens when what's normal in somebody's life, what's considered to be normal, changes. And that moment when the ground is felt to move beneath the feet of people who thought they were doing the right thing, people who told themselves they were stand-up members of their community, only to find out, no, you're actually a, insert the social issue here. So I think this is a moment that the United States is having, for example, around the Me Too movement. There are lots of people who were doing things that they call good old boys, sort of, you know, that they was considered to be normal in an earlier era and is now rightly considered to be completely unacceptable. That feeling that some people have of the ground moving underneath their feet is what I want to capture, because I'm not a criminologist. I want to be there when I see social change happening. And so in this moment, I didn't go and interview prisoners, people in prison who'd been arrested for human trafficking, for example. And I didn't interview repeat offenders, people who would do anything to make a buck, anything. They go to jail, they bribe themselves out of jail, and then they go and they do the same thing again. Like those are it's important we understand those people, but it's good for like criminologists and criminal pathologists or somebody understand them. I'm interested in people like me, people who are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. And when they learn about them, then have this moment where they have to decide what to do next. I don't even remember what your question was anymore. I got so excited about that. So I care about rights violators who are violating social norms and not laws, because I think that describes a huge cross-section of humanity. It's not just, well, what's happening in this little corner of India, which is where the book's set. But the implications, I think, ripple out into like my own life or my own family's life, or into we could have a conversation off mic and say, like, what are you doing right now that you really feel you shouldn't be doing? You know, like my carbon footprint's too big, right? And my kids will look back and ask me, how the heck did you have a carbon footprint that big and then sleep at night? And I'm going to have an answer to that. And I wrestle with that. And so it's less of like slaveholders, oh my God, they're from another planet, and much more asking questions about how in our own lives we find ways of excusing patterns of behavior that hurt other people and rationalize it because of some larger commitments we have, not ideologically, but because we're just part of a milieu in which these things are normal.
And what do slaveholders use as an excuse?
They say, "Oh, this is part of the milieu. This is just normal." That's what they say. No, so they responded with a sense of loss. I would go in, and in some cases, knowing that workers had revolted against their what do we call them? Employers, slaveholders, masters. What do you want to call them? Had these powerful men, they're all men, accustomed to power and privilege, had been challenged by who? By nobodies, right? And the conversations with that I had with them, what came through was this profound sense of hurt, disappointment, frustration. They would say nostalgia. They would say things like, in the past, it used to be like we were family. And now people only work according to money. Now people only want money, and they used to do it for love and affection. Well, wait, okay, now let's switch gears. What is love and affection? Coming from the area of human rights and social movements that I come from, I know that love and affection was underwritten by power disparities, coercion, violence. I would interview the victims, the survivors in many cases, who told me, oh yeah, he would beat me and he would threaten my children, right? So I know that there's this tension here. Right. And so what they would tell me is, I think, what they would often tell themselves, which is that they were doing workers a favor. that they were the lender of last resort for people that were completely left out of all forms of social inclusion, ignoring the fact that they were part of that social, they were part of the mechanism of social exclusion. So I'll finish there, but the things that they said to me suggested that they thought in many cases they were the victim of large changes, large social, economic, and political changes. They felt hurt because they had an earlier warm relationship with workers who now were just transactional, shift from, let's say, feudal relationships to some more capital and market-based exchanges. And across that, it became clear that they were, I was going to say, like rich characters, because I want to include the possibility that they were lying to me, that they were lying to themselves, that they don't know what to think, or they're in the middle of coming to a new understanding of what their relationship with these other members of their community should look like. And so I don't want to give them a free pass, and neither do I want to assume that their understanding of this moment is completely settled, if that makes any sense.
And also because, I mean, despite of this warm relation that they speak about, you also explain how they try to anticipate to certain needs. They try to strategize to make sure that the debt the slaves cannot be repaid, so the relation would be perpetual, right? So what are those strategies that they were using?
Yeah, so in a lot of cases, this happened in many cases, but one person in particular personified it well or represented it well. And he said, you know, you have to, it's impossible to have workers who are satisfied with the way that they're treated under these conditions if you don't know them. And you have to know who these people are. You have to know what they need. You have to know what they want. And that takes attention to detail. And it takes attention to their lives. So if you see that they're going to have a wedding in their family coming up and you know they don't have money, that's a good time to offer them a loan. And then to invite them to work for you. And so the way that the system works is people will take loans. They'll take a loan against a fixed amount of money as a loan against an unspecified duration of time for repaying the loan. And so they'll get something like $200, $70. Average loans are often in the 70 to 80 range. And then they'll work for an unspecified period of time. And it's either unspecified because the worker won't think to ask, how much longer do I have? Or the worker will think to ask, how much longer do I have? But then doesn't understand the answer because they're lacking some basic education. Or they ask and it's answered and they understand it and they push back, but then violence is actually used to keep them in this position. So it's important from the perpetrator or landlord, or how do you want to call them, slaveholder's perspective, to get people who are flexible and compliant in that way, and they could be coerced in that way. And so that's not a matter of just grabbing somebody off the street. That's a matter of knowing the other person. So all of a sudden, I'm going to use the word weaponized. I don't know if it's the right word, but relationship or intimacy is weaponized or operationalized for the economic gain of the perpetrator, because it's better if you don't have to use violence. It's better if you can use cajoling and manipulation and guilt. And so in some cases, a worker would not pay off their debt. And then the perpetrator would circle back around and call their family and say, you know that your brother or your son or your, you know, is not paying me back. I need for one of you to come work. And then the family would be the one that would call the recalcitrant worker and say, come back. You have a debt and an obligation. It would get reinforced by the family. So in this way, well, that's a much better way to extract free labor from somebody than the whip or the deed or the contract or the ownership papers, right? It's just is the subtle art of manipulation. So I'm going to stop there, but this should shed another, like, this should shade again this thing that they told me, which is we used to have a relationship. So do they miss like that time we would, you know, the deep talks we would have late into the night? Or do they miss the ability to use soft power to manipulate people into a hard position?
And then also when there is a challenge to this kind of relation of exploitation, it's not only workers or slaves who challenge this relationship, but there are also external factors that they pose a threat to the position of slaveholders. Which are those?
This is very surprising in my work. I came from the sort of social movement world, came from the community organizing world, and I thought I was going to hear from these perpetrators again and again and again, that damn NGO has cost me a lot of money. I thought they were going to very clearly out these external factors that come into their community. But what they were more worried about in time after time were things like the weather, which had, because of global warming, has led to less rainfall, which has led to less frequent and predictable crops, which has led to undermining of their economic stability. They complained about new government policies that favored marginalized people at the expense of the real victims, the perpetrators called themselves. And they also complained about changes that were in the market, changes in mobile telephony infrastructure. I mean, like cell phones and roads. They complained about cell phones and roads. They said, it used to be we had a captive audience here. They didn't say it that way exactly, but used to be that workers would always work for us and were happy to work for us. But now they have options that they can hear about because a family member goes to another city, calls them on a phone that they somehow have access to, or a neighbor's phone, or buses now come to our community on roads that are paved. And this wasn't the case in an earlier era. So this was the hands down most surprising thing for me, was the extent to which these larger market forces tied to the marketization of the Indian economy, big public policy moves by the national government, and the way those things, and then changes in technology, innovation and technology, the way those things actually kind of permeated or settled at the lived experience level of these relationships. And so that was a real puzzle for me. And I actually, everything I just said to you, I had to go and like really mull over after I came away, saying, why are they not pointing one large finger at the social movement organization? And I realized what was happening time after time is social movement organizations were leveraging those larger macro changes to their advantage. And so they were actually then able to redeploy new ideas about additional markets or new benefits from the government, and to bring those into the local context. So a policy would have been passed 10 years ago, but because of corruption, never came to the community. The nonprofit then helps, or the community organizing effort helps, bring that benefit to the community. And then the powerful then complain, not about the NGO, but about the government and the new policy, right? So it's this kind of missed attribution. They didn't always point to exactly, they pointed where they thought the pain was coming from. And sometimes I had a different analysis because I thought that policy was here for 10 years, but it never hurt you because there was nobody here to mobilize people to demand that right be operationalized in the real right here. And that was what they actually identified more easily.
So we have basically bonded laborers that they're confronting the system of exploitation sometimes. We have also community organizing. We have international NGOs. We have climate changes. We have policy changes. So how do perpetrators deal with all these factors and react to these very big social changes that they're facing?
The flip answer is they do it the way that we all do, which is with what resources we have, looking at the data and trying to figure out what to do. And by resources, I mean like we have money in the bank or we don't. We have debt or we don't. We have like a really creative way of thinking about things or we don't. And then we kind of figure out what to do. And I don't mean to be flip in that. I mean to bring this back to drawing a bridge between this kind of like radical other community, slaveholders, and I'll talk about me, my own life, right? Because they're as equipped as any of us are to deal with big changes in the market, big changes in policy, big changes in society. And they find themselves again with this feeling of the carpet moving, carpet being pulled out from under them, or the ground shifting beneath their feet. They have that feeling. That's not an alien feeling to people. It's that moment you realize somebody's going to break up with you and you're like, oh no, that's never happened to me. But that moment, I imagine, I've been told by others, that moment is something that's familiar. So what they did is they did something that's very different than social movement theory says, well, repression happens. Right? It's pretty simple. It's repression, or it's the social movement gets victory, which is that the other side quits, or the other side decides they're going to harass you in some way. They're going to send the police after you or make your organization illegal or whatever. And what I found in these conversations is that that's right, but it's a part of the story. And then the bigger part of the story is that these rights violators look at their resources and try to figure out what to do. And sometimes their first instinct is bad. And they think they have power that they don't have anymore because the social movement has been successful. So I saw cases where a perpetrator who had always gotten their way through violence was challenged by workers, and the workers say, refuse to work for free under the threats of violence anymore. And then violence stops working. And so the perpetrator says, I'll initiate violence. And then the perpetrator initiates violence. So I saw in one context, there's a rebellion. And the people rose up and they killed a member of the landlord class. And the landlord class were like put back on their heel. You know, they didn't know what to do next because that had never happened. And so they thought that the thing they were going to be able to do easily that had always worked in the past was going to work again. And so what this means is it's kind of simple. You know, you think about it, why did I just get dumped? Well, I got dumped because maybe I was inattentive and unresponsive and I'm not a good communicator. We do some self-assessment. So what I found is that these perpetrators, they underwent some self-assessment and not sort of, I see that I've been wrong all these years, but, maybe violence doesn't work. And they would shift other schemes and other plots and other plans. And sometimes those were just as manipulative and just as underhanded and just as extractive, but they were new and it was something, and it took some adaptation. And so the short answer to that is that some of them doubled down and tried even harder to fight for the old way of managing people through slavery. And they did this by doubling down on violence. And others gave up. They said, you know what? I looked at my assets. I looked at my resources. I looked at my debts. And I'm going to walk away from this thing. And I'm just not going to do it anymore. And in this way, I think the book is able to speak to those moments when perpetrators get worse and when they actually back off and decide that this is no longer a way of life that they're willing to live, which I think describes, again, where are these segregationists, right? There's this mutated into new forms of racism, but there are very few people advocating segregation now because they assessed the situation, they looked at the laws, they looked at big changes, and now they had to change their mind.
And now looking at the big picture, so what have you learned about slavery more broadly by talking to the perpetrators, by seeing how they strategize and how they face these dilemmas and so on?
It made me rethink the role of, not the role, I was going to say the role of public policy, but I should instead say the way that we're using public policy to address rights violations like slavery. So something like $1 billion has been spent in the first 10 years or so of the most recent wave of the anti-slavery movement. The anti-slavery movement is very old. It's a couple hundred years old. One of the earliest and most notable forms of mobilization against a human rights violation. This iteration has raised $1 billion, and a lot of that has gone toward doing very important work, identifying the needs, the issue and the needs of survivors, of victims and survivors. And that's important. But we know far less about how our policy interventions and how all of those dollars should be invested in reducing perpetration by perpetrators. And just one vignette might like shed light on this. In one interview with a perpetrator, it came to light that he had leveraged a worker, you know, the sort of initial debt he had used to leverage this worker to bonded that worker to him. He'd gotten that original debt from the Grameen, original money from the Grameen Bank. So this perpetrator, this contemporary slaveholder, is simultaneously a net beneficiary of an international banking program meant to lend money to the deserving poor. So this perpetrator is simultaneously a rights violator and a key aspect of a development theory. So we could be asking ourselves questions like, how is money spent in the aid and development world being used to actually help move perpetrators out of perpetrating livelihoods and into livelihoods that are non-exploitative, for example? So, there's a lot of other things that sort of redound from this that are more abstract, like what happens to human relationships over time when they've been marked by slavery. But just the top note public policy issue is we're spending a bunch of money on this. And if we are, we should be looking at the whole problem and not just a piece of the problem.
Okay. And already trying to wrap up the interview a bit. What are the, you think, like the key takeaways from your book and from what you have learned from being like for such a long time in India and talking to so many people involved in slavery, both as perpetrators and those who suffered it?
Yeah, The takeaway for me is like this last line from Solzhenitsyn that says that the line of good and evil cuts through the heart of all people, right? And that's the, I'm going to flip through the pages in front of the microphone. But this is the puzzle, right? The puzzle is, and this is a theme through our whole conversation, is how is it that people identify the moment that they're in and then recognize how to be on the right side of history? And it comes far more from a sense of, a sense that I in my own life am part of systems of oppression that I don't understand, than it is a sense of like, well, let's end slavery by, you know, focusing on people in some other place. But it's really, how can we better understand the moment that we're in order to be on the side of truth, justice, and beauty? That's the puzzle, right? So I'll leave it there.
And now also I was wondering, after having finished this book and having worked for such a long time on this, what are you currently working on?
Oh, this is like the now for something completely different. I just finished a book about drones, satellites, and hot air balloons because I'm fascinated by how new technology allows us to see things from new spaces and what that does for politics. And so while I was a member of the faculty at Central European University, where we met each other, I bought a drone for a class on human rights advocacy, and we used that drone to document protests. And it got me thinking about how it is that being able to document human rights violations or social movements from a new perspective shifts balances of power between the people and the powerful. And it turns out that lots and lots of work has been done on social media and the power of Twitter, the power of Instagram or Facebook, and these sort of networking technologies, but not a lot has been written about the about other technologies. Like we don't have a lot of books about the barricades, but they're an important part of, you know, the French Revolution. So anyway, it's a book about technology and how it affects social movements and challenges. Then I'm starting a new book that comes out of this project, in which I look at the perpetrators and their victims as a set. So this book came exclusively from conversations with perpetrators, but in my field work, I spoke to lots of people. And so I'm working on a book now that's going to explore those two sides, those two facets to the same relational moment.
And then from this work that you've been doing lately, which new books would you recommend to our audience if they want to learn more about slavery or about technology or social movements more general?
Yes, maybe two books. At the University of Nottingham, my colleague Kevin Bales, who wrote Disposable People, which is a seminal book in my field that everybody should read, has also written a new book called Blood and Earth. And it ties together the way that slavery and environmental degradation are bound up within one another. And he finds essentially that if we were to, like, lots of slavery contributes to global warming and contributes to the degradation of the environment. And if we were to address slavery, we would have a knock-on effect of essentially ending slavery and doing less harm to the environment, let's say. And then the second is, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but Arand Giridharadas has written a book called Winners Take All, How the Elite Charade of Changing the World. And it's like a critical take on the social entrepreneurship, Davos, Aspen Institute, TED Talk kind of way of having thought leaders who then have all these solutions, but then we overlook things like the importance of the state and regulating markets and that sort of thing. So it's a good provocative read. I recommend that.
So two very good recommendations. So thank you so much for the interview. Today I've been talking to Professor Austin Choi Fitzpatrick from the University of San Diego and the University of Nottingham about his book, who was published last year with Columbia University Press, What Slaveholders Think, How Contemporary Perpetrators Rationalize What They Do. So thank you so much for the conversation, Austin, and all the best.
This was fun. Thank you so much.